Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Maltese Catholicism in Detroit. This talk is delivered by Professor Mark Stanko.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. Welcome to the 11th and final seminar of this academic year in the seminar series, Work in Progress in the Social Studies. This series has been going for 16 years, and we're very happy to end this year's seminars with a paper given, by an American who has done his social research on Maltese Catholics and the Maltese Catholic community in Detroit. So I'm sure all of you who are interested in diaspora studies and all of you out there in the radio audience who are very, very interested in Maltese migrants to the United States will take an interest in tonight's seminar. Our guest speaker tonight, Mark Stanko, has his BA degree from Michigan Technical University, Michigan Technological University. His MA degree in history from Edinburgh University in Pennsylvania. And now Mark is working on his PhD in migration and ethnic studies at the University of West Virginia. He's a historian. This is also his second visit to Malta, I've just been told, because I suppose, for, among other reasons, his mother was a Maltese migrant to the United States. Okay? So, Mark, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you. We look forward to what you have to say.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I wanted to say thank you to the University of Malta and everyone for having me here and bringing me in to present. As Dr. Kuo was saying, my mother's family is from Malta originally. Her grandmother, or her mother and father, were from Malta. Though my last name is Stanko, hers is Mifsud. So there you go, that's a pretty common name. The project that I'm presenting today, and the paper I'm presenting today, is Maltese Catholicism in Detroit. It comes from the thesis that I wrote at Edinburgh University, Pennsylvania, which was on the topic, basically researching the diaspora, researching the community in Detroit, and trying to hone in on what gives Maltese individuals a sense of what it is to be Maltese. We're looking at a third generation in many cases in Detroit. So these are people who have likely never been to Malta. These are people who have very distant communication with whoever their ancestors are in Malta. So how do they, identify as Maltese Americans? And we were talking earlier about how it's not necessarily language. And a lot of people like to point out to language as being what keeps heritage together. From what I see in the Detroit community, it has more to do with the religion than it does with the language. As Dr. Kuo said, I'm going on for my PhD at West Virginia University, and I intend to turn this into a PhD dissertation, where I look more at the Detroit diaspora community and how it connects to Malta globally. I wanted to also thank the Maltese American Benevolent Society in Detroit, specifically Mark Treziak, who was very important in helping me get interviews and things while I was away in Pennsylvania and not in Detroit. So that was a huge help. All right, two starts. Just a little bit of basic geography so that we understand where we're dealing with here. You can see Michigan is outlined by the Great Lakes up there. Detroit is roughly where the N is in Michigan. So that's where a lot of Maltese moved in the 1920s. Shortly after World War I, obviously the dockyards stopped employing so many men, the war was over, and they took their industrial skills and went to work for companies like Ford and GM and other auto industries. So in the state of Michigan, you can see highlighted here is the Tri-County area, and in Wayne County is the city of Detroit. Now that's initially where most Maltese moved to. Today, they are spread out amongst that rough area, Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties. This is 1920s Detroit. This is what, and that doesn't show up at all, and I'm very sorry, it looks much better on here. but we'll just skip past that. This is a Google map of Detroit. Further on the geography lesson here, this is modern day. Here's the Detroit River, downtown Detroit, and this right here is called Porktown. It's a little little village in Detroit where the community moved to. And this is a close-up of it. Many of the Maltese in Detroit grew up in about this block area here, all the way over to 4th Street, which used to go straight, and in fact on 4th, and if you can imagine Plum Street continuing out, that's where St. Paul's Maltese Catholic Church once stood. It is now demolished, a freeway was laid, and it's now a, I believe, electrical plant. So nothing once stands there anymore. You can see this is of interesting importance. Mullet Park right here is actually dedicated for my grandmother's brother, a Maltese American who was killed in World War II, fighting with the United States in the Pacific. So there's a lot of little Maltese symbols here, and that's the only one that shows up on the map. But there are, the Maltese Club is right here roughly, and there's a lot of different Maltese identifiers throughout this part of Detroit. Maltese crosses, churches still bear Maltese individuals. So this part is the historic Maltese community of Detroit. So when they moved there, why did they move there, and basically what happened after they moved? Like we said, 1920, the dockyards in Malta stop employing people. They need places to go. Detroit is an attractive option. It's hiring thousands and thousands of foreigners, and the Maltese have something that a lot of these other southern and eastern European foreigners didn't have, and that was industrial skills. So they come over to Detroit, and they're immediately picked up by Ford and GM for their skills that they have. On top of that, there's a lot of English language that they already had working with the British. Not all of them were fluent, but most of them could at least understand the basics in English. So you have this double positive of being able to work in an industrial setting and speak English, which made the Maltese a very attractive immigrant group for the auto companies in Detroit. In fact, I believe the next slide is, well, this is the breakdown of our population that got thrown in there. In fact, it was interesting when I did this, the survey, 23% responded not even in the Tri-County area of Detroit, and those are mostly what we call snowbirds, older individuals who grew up in Detroit and moved to Florida for the winter and then come back to Detroit in the summer. So that explains that. But this is the English skills that I was getting at. I looked at census records in the 1920s and 1930s to see what the Maltese did when they worked and if they knew how to speak English. According to the census records, there's a huge difference of employment by all workers and employment with no English skills. 50% of the Maltese who had no English skills were just labeled as general laborers. The rest were labeled as no work, bricklayers, core makers, grinders, or painters. If you come down here to those who have English skills or just jobs in general, you see laborer, auto manufacturer, and machinist, auto manufacturer, make up a large majority of the group. So if you add in other auto manufacturer, over half those who spoke English and were working in Detroit were working for an auto company in some form or another. And then you have just general other laborers here as well. So the Maltese now have come to Detroit, they have good jobs, and what happens is they write home and they say, we have good jobs, they want more, and their brothers, their cousins, their nephews, other individuals start coming over as well. And in fact, that's what made them a very popular choice. Now, unfortunately, we had the Great Depression, and a lot actually went home after that happened. Just there were no jobs here, and they weren't necessarily that all established in Detroit. So they go back to Malta, where there still weren't any jobs. And most of those would end up coming back after World War II. And then that was about it for migration in Detroit. About 52, the Walter McCarran Act comes in. There's a strict quota placed, and the Maltese turn and go to Australia instead of the United States. And we know, obviously, Australia has a huge Maltese population now. So how does religion then fit into this community? Well, and this is a church service ad that I pulled from the Detroit News in 1920, and all of these are some sort of ethnic church here, and it was a Christmas ad, so this was basically advertisements for Christmas Eve masses, and there were things on there from almost every ethnicity you could imagine. So when immigrants came to Detroit, clearly ethnicity was a part of their church experience. And what we see is a lot of times these are a way to get back with the community, be one with the community. And one of the things that was written is that, yes, there was a social club, perhaps, but social clubs were viewed at the time as dirty. Men were only allowed to go there. Women, children were generally told not to. They were told that basically what's discussed there are politics, American and Maltese, and gambling. So where it is safe to go meet as a community is the church. That's a good environment for the community to meet in. So with that, the Maltese established their church in 1920. Bishop Gallagher of Detroit decided it was time to appoint a priest for the Maltese community and sent word to Malta to send a priest to Detroit. The man he sent in 1920 was Father Michael Borge, who is figured here in his later years. And at one point, he entertained a thought of moving to Australia, even in 1920s. However, he accepted the call to Detroit because, quote, that was the place where everyone seemed to be going. So he would begin his service at St. Paul's Maltese Church, which was established in 1920, and they celebrated their first Mass on November 14th. By the end of 1922, 74 Maltese baptisms, 7 weddings, and 21 funerals occurred at St. Paul's. An early member of the community, Paul Portelli, wrote home to his uncle in 1921, complaining that though they had carnival celebrations, they weren't as large as they were at home, and that's what he missed the most. So you can see, obviously, that these are, you know, important events. They've established a community, a church in Detroit. In fact, talking to another individual, Joe Mamo, and he was an immigrant in the 50s, and now he lives in Detroit, he mentioned that the festas that Mr. Portelli wrote about were so important because, according to Mr. Mamo, that is what keeps the Maltese together, and that we're so vigilant about their saints and patron saints that they even fight and swear over it. So clearly we're getting, obviously, religion into our ethnic lives. However, the Maltese community ran into a period of divide, and despite his longstanding post, Father Cheffai, who took over for Father Borge, presided over a time of recognizable divide, and an author on the Detroit community of Catholics, not just Maltese, Catholics in general, wrote that about the 1940s, you started having issues in these communities, especially in the Maltese community, where it was almost more tribal views of the outside world, as she puts it. You view the outside world as, if you're not with us, you're against us. And what happened with the Maltese community is they tended to go to whatever church was closest to their house. So if St. Paul's wasn't the closest one, they might only go there for the big festivals. And they might go to the neighborhood church for their own services. Well, Father Cheffai in the 40s and 50s was very upset about this. And in fact, he was what you might actually call a purist. He despised Maltese who would marry non-Maltese individuals. He thought that was impure. He despised those who didn't actually go to the Maltese church. In fact, he was reported to say that he knew of a very good many Maltese men who were married, and unfortunately their wives were Polish. So it wasn't even that they weren't marrying non-Catholics. It was that they're marrying non-Maltese. So that was a big issue. And my own grandmother told me a story of when her brother had died, that they wanted him to be buried, or wanted his funeral procession at another church besides St. Paul's, because it was the church they attended. And that apparently made Father Cheffai very, very mad that they wanted it somewhere else instead of at St. Paul's. So there was a bit of tension in the 1940s. And as I've discussed, after World War II, immigration to Detroit slowed. So now what you have is an aging population, essentially, stuck in the 1940s, and it's getting older. It's becoming more American as each generation grows up. In fact, the second generation generally was never taught Maltese. In attempts to become Americanized in the 60s and 70s, these children were being taught only English. They might hear Maltese growing up. They might understand a word here and there, but they don't know how to converse fluently with others in that language. So the language began to die out, and I could say with good probability that the use of the language today is slim to none. In 1957, however, going back historically, St. Paul's was closed by the Archdiocese of Detroit. They began to institute a new plan, which essentially prohibited the rehabilitation of ethnic churches. They foresaw the flee to the suburbs, the fact that the community churches in what was old downtown Detroit were beginning to deteriorate, and that the community wasn't there to rebuild it anymore. In this case, with the Maltese community, that was evident. Many of them were moving out to suburbs like Dearborn, Westland, and Farmington, which are all at least 10 miles away from the core of downtown Detroit. It makes it difficult to attend and keep this church running. So in 1957, it was slated for demolition, and in 1958, St. Paul's Maltese Catholic Church in Detroit was physically destroyed. However, Catholic organizations continue to operate within the Maltese community in Detroit. And here we have the Missionary Society of St. Paul, which was founded in 1957 here in Malta with the, quote, mission to minister to Maltese people throughout the world. And Detroit was sent Maltese ministers as well. So here is a picture of some Maltese members of the community with a Maltese priest in their home in Detroit. This is dated, I believe, 62. So this is shortly after the ministry was actually founded. So you have now these individuals coming to the Detroit community. There is no physical church that holds the Detroit Catholic community anymore with St. Paul's destroyed. So they meet at separate churches. Oftentimes the community clubs turn into a church on a Sunday afternoon. And what we have here is the continuation of Maltese chaplains being basically awarded to the community. So here, and let me get the name right because I don't want to mess that up. I believe this is Father Corona, who came over in the 70s, and he was there until, I believe, the mid to late 80s. And here he's at the Maltese club, but you can't really see it very well on that screen. But they're celebrating Mass, and essentially that's what they did. In absence of having an actual church to call their own, they would use the community clubs to celebrate their Mass. In 1957, the year that the church was actually destroyed, the Detroit News ran an article about the Maltese to celebrate their honor, or to celebrate their victory over the Turkish Sultan. The article reads that, quote, according to the beliefs of the devoutly Catholic Maltese people, the Blessed Virgin came to their aid and expelled the Turks, and on the 8th of September is also known as the Feast of Our Lady of Victory. So that feast, which was started in 1957 in Detroit, or at least was noted as being around in 1957 in Detroit, was continued. And I have a picture later of it. Actually, we went to it last fall, September. And so that still continues to Detroit. They still continue to have the Il Festa Victoria Day, I believe I'm saying that right, in downtown Detroit. So this is something that continues to carry on heritage-wise. So I figured it'd be good to look at who we're dealing with generation-wise in Detroit. I did a survey last year as part of my thesis of the community, and this is rough, of about 200 members. The first generation, as you can see, is now less than 20% of the community. It's beginning to die off, as you would assume, being 1920 to 1945, the rough dates of migration. You have a very large second generation, a growing third, and a small and also growing fourth generation. At that point, though, I question how much Maltese you are and how interested you just might be in the culture. But needless to say, you have a less and less Maltese population in Detroit. So I asked them what they thought was a key to maintaining Maltese heritage in Detroit. And the green is yes here on the right, the no is on the left. So I asked if they thought that language was key to maintaining the community and maintaining the ethnic heritage in the community. And as you can see, every group was pretty much close to split with a lean to the yes side, except for the second and third, which were largely in favor of language as being a key. So I asked a follow-up question. How well do you speak Maltese? Because if you think it's a key, maybe there's something to it. Well, the first generation, as you would assume, fluently is in blue, but intermediate in green, and basic in beige. First generation, at least basic to fluent. The second generation, you can see the huge drop off to basic to none at all. And then the third generation, that continues with almost with none fluent and just very few intermediate. So if language is so important to them, and they think it's so important to maintaining the community, how come no one speaks it? And then what does that say about the community? A later question asked, do they think the community is strong? And almost all of them responded, yes. They think that the Maltese community in Detroit is strong. So what we see here is a big divide in what they say and what they actually do. I continue that question on to how well do you read Maltese, and again, the colors are the same, and the graph gets worse. And then, of course, write Maltese and almost no one. So that led me to ask the further question. Well, how important do you believe that religion is to Maltese identity and Maltese culture? And you can see the blue is absolutely, green is somewhat, and there was actually a third option to say not at all, which no one selected at all. So you can see the overwhelming response saying that religion absolutely plays an important part in Maltese culture. So then I asked, how often do you attend church? Well, the first generation, weekly, the second generation, weekly still with a smattering of others, and then the third and the fourth are sort of mixed, not really, holidays only, you know, go on Christmas, go on Easter, and that's good for the year. So that's an interesting play there. And then I asked them what their religions were, and of course, as you might guess, overwhelmingly Catholic in almost every single chart. So then I asked them, how important was religion to you? If you think it's important to the Maltese culture, is it important also to you then? And what I got was actually favorably responded on almost all the categories here. Somewhat's in green, very is in blue. And you can see for most of the generations, it's either very important or somewhat important in their lives. And as you go back to the chart that shows their going to church rates, that doesn't necessarily mean they go to church. That just means that they feel it's important to their lives. So then, what it comes to, and I again apologize, some of these pictures aren't very good. What it comes to is, how does that translate and how can the Detroit community then build on that idea of community of the church and not a community of the language? My personal thought is, looking at the language situation, is that it's pushed often by the Maltese communities in Detroit. There's a community club in Dearborn, which is a suburb, and there is one in downtown Detroit. Both offer language classes for free to their community members. However, the attendance is sparse. It's been going on for 6 or 7 years, and it doesn't seem to improve any of the language capabilities of individuals. My thought is there's no infrastructure for that. Maltese newspapers, which in Detroit did exist in the 1920s, no longer exist. Maltese radio station, which actually existed in the 70s and 80s, they had an hour-long block every week in the 70s and 80s, no longer exists. And we're also seeing the first generation, who are the ones that speak it fluently to intermediately, dying off. So that no longer exists. So what we have is a lack of basic infrastructure to build on for language retention. Going down the street, it's just easier to speak English than it is to speak Maltese. But what we still have is an attachment to the Catholic Church, an attachment to religion, attachment to festivals that keep our heritage together. And here we have another Maltese mass, and I believe that is Monsignor Gretsch from Gozo, who came over and visited in 2007 the Detroit community. And here he is again with some young parishioners at the church in Allen Park. And once again, and I really do apologize, they were good pictures on the laptop. And here we have the actual chaplain today of the Maltese community, whose name I really am blanking on right now. And that's killing me. And that'll come to me, and I will tell you when it does. So what we have then, Father Joseph Malia, there we go. I knew I put it on a slide. Okay. And Father Joseph Malia was awarded the honor of canon in the Church of the Immaculate Conception here in Malta, I believe in 2007, for his work in the Maltese community overseas. So that's actually him on the left there. Yeah, your left. Accepting that. And then this is a picture on the right of him celebrating a service in the club in Dearborn. These are pictures of, and again, the quality is terrible, but these are pictures of the Festa of Vittoria in Detroit this past year. And they carry, here is the American and here is the Maltese flag, since we can't see it. I'll describe it for you. And in front of that, they're carrying the Blessed Virgin Mary statue, just like they would in processions here. And this was a very big event. It was attended very well. There were Maltese crosses all over the church. And the church was Most Holy Trinity in Corktown, Detroit, which was a church that many Maltese had actually visited throughout the years. And there's another picture. This is not a religious picture, but this is just Tonio Borge came and was accepted an award. I forget what it was for. But he came and visited the community. And that's just to show that individuals besides religious figures do visit the Detroit community, and they are received. Also, the famous Maltese tenor here also came, made a performance a couple years ago. It was a huge success. And then the Maltese American Club in Detroit. So that's in Detroit, and this is the one in Dearborn. You can see it's quite prominent. So this is the background of Most Holy Trinity Church. This is where they have the festival every year. And what you can see in the background here behind the altar are Maltese crosses in the corner. It also has the Irish clover, and it has the Puerto Rican, whatever the Puerto Rican flower is. I'm not really sure what that is. But it's also there. It's the three denominations that celebrate and worship Mass there most often. So there's something standing still in Corktown, religiously, of the Maltese presence in that area. And so it's nice to go back there and continue to celebrate that. Now what I wanted to go to up here was, this is the outside of Most Holy Trinity. That's my grandmother. And the Corktown, Detroit's oldest neighborhood. And I told my family I would take them to Malta, so here they are. In Malta, near the Mullet Natural Area. My mother on the left, grandmother, aunt. And that's the Mullet Playfield. So that's essentially that presentation right there. But what I basically have proposed in my thesis and what I've concluded is that religion is the key to what keeps the Maltese culture and heritage alive in the Maltese community. The Festa of Vittoria is just one of many festivals that actually occur every year in Detroit. And they all have religious connotation. In fact, one of the busiest nights for the Maltese Club in Dearborn is the Christmas Eve Mass. I mean, the whole day is packed. It's a huge festival, and it's actually quite nice. Additionally, every meeting in the Maltese clubs begin with prayer. You have lots of other religious hints here and there that really bring out sort of a Catholic feel that connect you to what it is to be Maltese. So for me, I look at religion and I say this is, has to be something we capitalize on. I know I read something about the Maltese in England, and they're talking about how they took basically Fagoli and they made them into into rabbits or other things that symbolize Easter in Britain. So that way the kids are interacting with Fagoli, and it's a British-Maltese mix. So they're accessing their heritage through something that's familiar to them. And in fact, we started making Fagoli in my household and in others in Detroit, and we sort of do the same thing. It's not the way it is in Malta, but it's accessing something that's part of your heritage. And using Fagoli and making pastitsi over holidays are sort of heritage links that I think can be made stronger through these church associations and should be focused on by communities overseas, and perhaps maybe just the Detroit community should focus on it, and I haven't studied any of the other ones yet. But it should play a more prominent role, in my opinion, than it does now. And that, I think, is about all I have for you.
Thank you very much, Mark, for a fascinating presentation. I'm sure you'll get questions. I'll just open up with one question. Did you get a feeling in the research as to whether ties through the father might be stronger or lead to more living heritage sequences than ties through the mother? For example, your mother was Maltese.
I didn't even ask that question, but I don't think they're at the third generation level. I'm not sure that's necessarily the issue as it is proximity to a social club. If you live in one of the suburbs that is so far away that you have no real proximity to that club, you're not in a community where there might be other Maltese around, you might just see yourself as more of an American than as any ties to your heritage links. And I think that's a big issue, is that there are so spread apart in Detroit that a lot of Maltese Americans who might be Maltese Americans don't even associate with the Maltese part because there's no one to associate with. They're third generations, they're American as any American might be. But those who might live closer to the community club, or maybe their parents, mother or father, are more active in the community, they might also become more active in the community.
Well, Mark, first of all, thank you, because I'm always so disappointed to see that the Maltese American community is the least researched of all diaspora studies concerning Maltese in the world, for some reason. As I told you, I have a student who's just graduating with an MA on Maltese Americans. But for the rest, Australia is very much more researched, even Canada, and even Britain. So I don't know what the reason for this is, if it's the melting pot philosophy, which, there was no kind of multicultural encouragement officially in the USA until quite recently. But the other point which I noticed is that you came to the same conclusion that I did in my study on religion and ethnic identity in Australia. Maybe you did it a bit more scientifically than I did, but the conclusion is similar, almost identical, that religion is a stronger core value intergenerationally than language. Now, of course, this opens up a can of worms because, language and the Maltese language, what sort of cultural baggage did these people take to their host countries? Maltese in the 20s and 30s didn't even have a standard orthography. And was considered by many people then, and perhaps still today, actually, including many parents, as a waste of time to actually study it, whereas, of course, English, from a utilitarian point of view, would be so much more useful, like getting jobs with GM and Ford.
Yeah.
even if it's a smattering of English. So language seems to have withstood assimilationist pressures much better than language. In Australia, the Maltese assimilate more than most other ethnic groups. In fact, they are only second to the Dutch in the rate of assimilation. Now, again, that begs many questions. But essentially, it's a familiarity with English, or Englishness, or Britishness. It could be a perception which then has consequences in other areas, such as employment. So the tendency seems to be similar. And of course, the importance of the festa continues. The feast of the 8th of September in West Melbourne and St. Mary's is, I've actually attended a number of those feasts myself when I lived in Melbourne, continues. And the 8th of September, which is the 8th of September, is the date, as you may know, of the lifting of the Great Siege, but also the date of the lifting of the Second Great Siege, which was the Second World War, to the surrender. So that has continued in the diaspora, obviously also in the States, as the day which most Maltese relate to as their national day. And in fact, very few people know that the first person to publicly demand that the 8th of September be made into Malta's national day and observed as Malta's national day was the leader of the Nationalist Party on the 8th of September 1885 in the Palace Square, and almost got himself arrested for it, of course. So that continues, that lingers on. Since then, of course, we have had many changes in national days. I cannot count them, but, we've changed and changed again and again and again and again, and we're still trying to find one. But I was very intrigued to see your, further research.
Well, thank you. And I will say, you mentioned about religion in Australia, and I forget the author, and this is also killing me, but he wrote that all he wishes his son is, his son doesn't have to be a Catholic, but he just hopes that he holds on to the Maltese part of the religion for the cultural aspect, cultural heritage of it, whether or not he worships as a Catholic, or whatever he chooses to do, but the author feels that there was something to be said for the heritage base in the religion. So whether or not he's Catholic, as long as the heritage of the church continues, then the heritage of the Maltese would continue in that community. Something to that effect. I can't remember the quote.
How does history figure? History as heritage in the Maltese psyche?
Yeah.
Is it just blissful ignorance?
Probably.
The interaction between the church and the language. Was the mass, for example, said in Maltese, or did it change over at a particular year?
The early masses were said in both Maltese and English. There would be a Maltese mass, I believe, in the morning, and an English mass later. I would say, however, that sort of disappeared from newspapers by the 40s. It was almost all English, Latin and English. But Maltese is sparingly used in church today, even in all Maltese mass, even at the festas. They might say one part of the sermon in Maltese, but most of it's English. So I think as the community grew, the Maltese part of the church fell out. Language.
So that would be an interaction between the language part and the religion part.
Correct. And if that had continued, perhaps language would have something to build off of in the community, or a use in the community, but it unfortunately ceased.
My other quick question is, you use the word diaspora. I'm a mechanical engineer, so I don't know. What does it mean?
It means a global community of individuals. So for the Maltese community, it would be that Maltese diaspora would be anyone who identifies as Maltese, whether they're in the United States or Australia or Malta or Britain. That would be sort of what the word is used for in our field, yeah.
My last quick question is, I forgot who hinted it, but was there a change in policy in the U.S. from where before sort of it was better to get integrated and recently it's more trying to bring up the ethnicity?
I don't know if there was an official change in policy, but there has been a change in, I think, public attitude towards ethnicity. It's no longer about becoming Americanized, and it's no longer everyone has to be a melting pot, but of celebration of who you are as an ethnicity. And I think that's what is driving a lot of the community clubs to try to sort of rebirth the language in the community, is to celebrate our ethnicity as other communities do. And of course, against communities like the Poles or the Italians, who are much, much larger, the language never really died out, so it's easier to sort of kickstart and celebrate that heritage than it would be in a smaller number of Maltese.
My father grew up in the 20s. I mean, he would talk about some of the immigrant kids he went to school with, and I mean, there were some Italians where he went. And if they started speaking Italian, the kids, their parents, who couldn't speak English very much, might smack them and say, "Speak English." So, and I would say that doesn't go on anymore. I mean, there is encouragement to try to learn both. So I would agree that there was this, it wasn't caused by the government by any means, no, but just, I want to fit in and come and join the economy, you know. Anyway.
Yes, all in all, you give a sort of an impression that this Maltese community in the United States and Detroit is finally, this bondage, it seems to be dying out. What is the number of inhabitants in Detroit and the outer area who identify themselves as being Maltese today?
It's about 40,000. And that's all the generations, first, second, third, and whatnot. But that's in a community of over 5 million. You know, if you do the spread of Metro Detroit, metropolitan area, it's about 5 million individuals. So 40,000 is still just a drop in the bucket. But compared, it is a sizable community, obviously, of overseas Maltese. Yeah.
Yes, and there's a Maltese embassy today in New York. Mm-hmm. Sure. I dare say, doesn't have a policy of stimulating cultural interest in Malta amongst the Maltese population in Detroit?
Well, I know there is a consulate in Detroit, a Maltese consulate, who operates out of Detroit, and I know that they're a part of, it's the International Group of Maltese Living Abroad, and they actually are a part of that and in conversation with, I think it's New York, Toronto, San Francisco, and a couple of the Australian cities that really, and I think Britain has just sort of a general, I don't know if they're focused anywhere, but there is a little bit of that, but I'm not sure there's any policy making going on. I know when they would try to start the language learning, they had to sort of beg the Maltese government for free language books to be sent. And that took a long time and delayed the class for months, but they came up.
I would like to ask another question. That is, you are a historian or anthropologist. Would there be any of these, like may call themselves Maltese from Detroit, who have written their memoirs, for example, have published their memoirs, because that's another treasure?
I was really hoping so. I haven't found any yet. I've been asking individuals if they've written anything, if their parents had written anything, and I haven't found anything yet. I really started researching this about a year ago, so it's very early stages of that type of research. I'm hoping over the PhD course I can find something somewhere, because that would be a wonderful treasure to have.
I was thinking of an American author, I think. She has your surname, I'm sure, but she calls herself as Massoud. And it seemed she was, her parents were born in Algeria, but they emigrated not to France, but rather to the United States. And she's a novelist, and she's published a fiction about the experiences she lived through, you know, the emigration, etc., yeah. etc. That would be a very good example.
For example.
So How do you account for competing ethnic identities in second and third generation Americans? You know, I'm thinking, for example, I'm third generation American. I identify as Finnish, German, Norwegian. And if I want to learn things about my culture, I only have so much time, right? So I'm competing as to whether I'm going to pick up the German language or the Finnish language, or do I look at German knitting patterns or Finnish ones when I'm knitting? You know, how do you account for that when people are self-identifying as Maltese and they might have other ethnicities mixed in there?
Yeah, and that's a very good question. I think that's part of the problem with America is that you have this melted pot of individuals who have multiple ethnic identities. Some choose to follow one. I'm also, I think, Czech and Italian, but if you were to ask me, I'd say I'm a Maltese American. So what do you identify with? And, you know, that's why when I made this survey, I said, do you identify as a Maltese American? If they answered no, their survey didn't count. They're not, you know, they're not identifying as a Maltese American. And that, I think, is the further problem as further generations go on to a fourth and a fifth generation. If you're 12% Maltese, is that really Maltese? How, you know, maybe if you connect to the heritage, but that's going to become an issue, obviously, in the future, much more so than it is now. I mean, now you have a lot of third generations who might still be half, you know, their mother might be full Maltese, but they're just not, it's going to be a big problem, and I don't really know how to identify that and how to address that, really.
But this brings up a huge issue in ethnicity.
Yeah, exactly. And if you feel that you're Maltese, even though you have blood from other countries, well then, okay, you're Maltese. And, you know, in this case, you don't have time to go learn Maltese and Italian and Czech and go to all the... So you have to pick and choose what you pick from each ethnicity, I suppose.
But this brings up a huge issue in anthropology, in the anthropology of ethnicity, which is that various ethnic markers of identity, various cultural identities, are indeed chosen. They are not something primordial. And secondly, blood, as has been shown in so many cases, is not the major factor in determining a cultural identity. You know, it's this difference between nature and culture, which Levi Strauss pointed out, and anthropologists generation after generation have pointed out. I mean, politics, as we all know, is one of the forces which makes people opt for one identity rather than another. Am I Serb? Am I Croat? Am I Bosnian Muslim? You know, in situations of melting pot where there is political competition of all kinds, especially for economic resources, then people literally choose one identity over another. So I think it's well known that, I mean, we even had a BA study, a BA because here our students all do a BA dissertation. And this is quite a long one, of an Indian community in Seattle. J.P. Baldacchino went to Seattle to visit and live with the Indians for 6 weeks. And it was one of the striking factors in Indian ethnicity in the United States, apparently, I'm just basing this on JP's reading as well as his findings, is that blood as such becomes a smaller and smaller proportion. There was so much intermarriage that it's common in the Seattle reservation, where he did his research, for people's blood quota to be less than 25% Indian. And yet still, for all kinds of reasons, they or their parents have chosen to opt for the reservation, to opt for the Indian identity. So I think this is a fascinating area. And how people go about making these choices is a very fascinating, very, very fascinating question.
Did you, by any chance, I don't know about your methodology. Did you go into these people's houses, or did you just send questionnaires, or?
I sent general questionnaires for the survey. That was just online, generally done. But then for interviews and things, I would go to the festivals and go to the community clubs afterwards, and they knew that I was going to be there. They had forewarning. So if they wanted to come and talk about their experiences, I was very willing to talk to them.
No, because I was going to ask you regarding this element of religion as part of their identity? Because when you said, they said that religion is important, but then you quoted statistics of not going to church, because obviously that is only just a very small element of being religious or of being Catholic. I mean, I'm sure many Maltese would still claim that they're Catholic, even though half of them are not going to church now. So that's why I asked, maybe I think that religion is not part of our identity at all. Even though in Malta nowadays there are different religions, did you ask these people why they believed that religion was important for their community? Because I mean, just by measuring their church attendance is not enough. It could be that as an ethnic group, Catholicism drew them apart from other communities, and they just identified with it, just to, as Paul was saying. I also wanted to ask you whether the Maltese community, for example, interacted more with non-Maltese who are Catholic than with other groups, for example, whether you noticed this.
Right. Well, in response to your first question, that was one of the things I would ask them when they would sit down and talk to me is, how do you feel you're Catholic? How often what importance does the church play? So I could get their response. And a lot of times, individuals would say, yes, I'm Catholic, but no, I don't go to church. I had an individual who was a migrant in 67. He came to Detroit. He worked for Ford. And I asked him, you know, if he believed. And I was born and raised Catholic. You know, I still go to, you know, Catholic things. But after the church scandals and all that stuff, he just didn't really see the point in going to church or that. And so you do have that, individuals in the community who say they're Catholic and they do Catholic things here and there, Christmas Mass, Easter Mass, but they don't go every week. So I think it does play a large part, even if they do or do not attend, if that answers your first question.
I think this is a growing issue in religious studies, that in fact, identifying with a religion doesn't mean, you know, what the dogmas say.
But hold on, I think one thing that's unique here is in the States, I think that Mark is pointing out, is we have unique cultural identities around religion. So there are German Lutherans and there are Finnish Lutherans, and they have different churches. I know, because I have both in my family. And they, even in their denominations, practice very slight differences in their Lutheranism. And I think what you're kind of pointing out here is that even among the Catholics practicing in the States, there's the same thing. There might be people who identify as Maltese Catholics, and that's just a unique phenomenon in the United States among both our Catholic and our Protestant religions, is that we parcel off these small communities within a larger church that probably in other countries is much more homogenous.
In the Archdiocese of Detroit, they will identify in the 1920s that 48 of their new parishes were ethnic parishes compared to regular Catholic parishes. So they do identify, even at the Archdiocese level, that the ethnic churches are built and established differently than the normal churches. And to go back to your question about 1920, or when they first came over, did they identify with other Catholics? Because I didn't get to that. Yeah, they did. In fact, in 1920s, in a lot of northern American cities, Catholics were viewed just as poorly as the African American populations. And so they bonded together. Catholics would bond together. And so that was absolutely part of it. In fact, the Maltese lived in a community with Mexicans, usually Mexican Catholics. And so they would attend the same church, and they would bond together over the Catholic faith. Well, the war, World War I ending, the need for employment wasn't as high as it was during the war, so there was unemployment from the dockyards.
We'll talk about employment in a minute, but let's keep on with some of these questions about religion for the moment.
You know, in your future studies, you think you could get to the generations and get a better feel for what the religion means. When they go and say, it matters a lot to me, do they mean this in some sort of doctrinal way or just simple performance? You know, does it change between the generations? I mean, I think that would be interesting empirically to get at some of this that would, you know, maybe I mean, obviously Malta's changing as well with more and more, you know, secularism and so forth, but nothing like in the U.S. And so we're, I am agreeing with you that there's certainly way, Americans are more religious than any people in an industrialized country, you know. But I think breaking down by the generations and trying to get a better measure of what is that religious experience in that community might be useful. And then presumably there's not, I don't know anything about this, but there might be comparisons for the Italians or the Mexicans and, you know, and others.
Yeah, it might be. And I would like to do that, actually, you know, given that the doctoral dissertation, I'll have more time for the research. But what I did find written in there, the author who wrote about the Archdiocese of Detroit, Leslie Woodcock Tentler, she writes that the new generations don't have the same fear of damnation and of hell and of God as their grandparents did. So this idea of going to church because you're damned to go to hell just doesn't exist to this generation anymore.
Turning briefly, perhaps, to a somewhat different area of your findings, Mark, I was intrigued that economically, was it 23% of your sample or of the population, the Maltese American population, I forget which, were what you call snowbirds, people who go to Florida for the winter. Does that imply that we have a fair quarter or more of Maltese Americans are obviously economically quite successful, financially well off to do these trips, or perhaps have a second home in Florida?
I would say so. I think if you look at the Maltese Americans, they assimilated quite well. In fact, many are business owners, or they have saved up enough through their retirement packages with Ford. And a lot of them came through at a time when you could get a good retirement package from the companies you worked for. And so they do winter in other places, Arizona or Florida. So I think that's, you might see the 23% as mostly your first generations who have retired and moved on, or a small minority of that percentage was also college students in the third generation who were living in their college town away from Detroit, but still identify as being a Detroiter and a Maltese American from Detroit.
These are obviously fascinating and cross-cutting questions of different identities.
The highest rate of home ownership of all the ethnic communities in Australia is the Maltese one. What does home ownership tell you? Hard work, savings, thrift, you know, concerned with autonomy, having your own, owning your own home, not just, you know, renting out and so on. So I don't know how that rates with the American experience or the Michigan experience in terms of home ownership. For example, are there any statistics which say of the ethnic groups, what are the ratings? It's very interesting because it ties to what Paul was saying.
Yeah, I don't know what the percentage would be, and I'm not sure if those stats are kept, but you could. Okay, yeah. One of the interviews I had with actually the migrant from 67 who moved to the United States, worked at the foundry for Ford for 30 years, I believe, and he told me it was a terrible job. He hated it, but he did it so that his sons and daughters could go off to college, go get the job they want to do, and then he retired and they did it. They went to college. So I think you see that probably a lot throughout the community.
But what skill sets did the Maltese have? And you said that they had skill sets that allowed them to go to Detroit. Like, why did they have those skill sets over the other immigrants? What history was there?
Just the type of working in a dockyard, pipe fitting, welding, some sort of work with industrial equipment that perhaps a farmer from, let's say, Greece wouldn't have, or something to that sort. Because in 1890-1920 range is when we had the big migration from Eastern and Southern Europe to the United States. And very often they were rural, poor peasants who were looking for an opportunity to create something for themselves in the United States. So to have a population come to the United States that was not coming from necessarily rural and poor, although rural and poor Maltese did move to the United States, a lot did come from dockyard work, familiar with machinery, familiar with how that works. 9 to 5, or well, not 9 to 5, but 9 to a lot later than 5 back then. But they weren't working for themselves. They weren't farmers who, you know, worked on their own time schedule, so they understood that a little bit better. Well, those who came were the ones that were likely unemployed from the dockyards. You see the largest population boom in Detroit in 1919 and 1920 of Maltese. And so you have the mass dismissals from the dockyard with thousands of employees laid off looking for a job. It's at the same time that the auto factories are beginning to boom in Detroit. So as this is becoming depressed, Detroit is growing, and it provides that sort of influx area for them.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mark, for what's been a very interesting talk and also a very interesting discussion afterwards. Hope to see you back in Malta. Hope to see you doing some more research. This is a huge area. We're very happy to have Professor Henry Frenro with us tonight, and we're going to seize this opportunity to invite him to give a talk on the Australian Maltese community next year. I think that what's interesting here is the comparisons between different Maltese communities in different parts of the world.
Are there still Maltese people coming to Detroit based on having a cousin sort of there and actually settling in Detroit?
I don't think there's a sizable portion. It might be a few every year or so, but you do see occasionally, and unfortunately in Detroit there aren't really that many jobs for them to come to at this moment. So,
but actually picking up on this item, a few years ago I studied at Auckland University myself, and there was quite a decent number, for example 15 people, mostly from engineering, that went and studied there, and I believe right now there are still two that they have settled there now.
Where was that?
So we were all studying at Auckland University,
engineering, okay. Yeah.
But their wives, so some of those Maltese engineers actually had their wives over with them, so the wives were teachers and the nurse, and two of those sort of stayed.
Yeah.
However, it'll be interesting, I think, to you, Mark, to look at the possibility of cyclical migration to Detroit. We had an excellent BA dissertation by Fiona Shibaras in 2002 in anthropology, in which she focused on New Yorkers in Gozo, and it's a word, I think it was a word in as it were, Gozotan Maltese, N-U-Y-O-R-K-E-R, New Yorkers. They're a feature of the Gozotan society, and it's a fascinating pattern, which when I went to New York, I directly saw myself. That is to say, this was going on until the 1970s, and for all I know, it may still be going on. In the 1970s, which would have been the latest period I think Fiona's figures would have referred to, young couples went to the States, worked as superintendents in the skyscrapers and high-rise in New York, and I found out in New York they're still doing this, lived rent-free and all utility bills free, accumulated what in Gozo are known as white goods, which every few years they would bring back and sell in Gozo, fridges, ovens, things like that, educated their children in Catholic schools, which of course means paying, to a certain extent, in the New York area, but made a point of returning to Malta before their oldest girl was likely to fall in love. That is to say, and this was the whole thrust of the thesis, the whole idea was to earn from the United States, from this trajectory of cyclical migration, build up savings, build a big house back in Gozo, but return. The problem was for the children. her estimate, based upon case studies, was that maybe 50%, half would integrate back in Gozo again. The other 50% ended up returning to the United States because they felt more American than Maltese. And it'll be interesting to see if you find this kind of cyclical economic migration going on in Detroit as well?
I'd be interested to find that out. There was a paper I read about the same type of migration for Italian Americans who would come to New York, and they would work for 8 months, go back home, they would build up their farmhouse with the money they made, and then go back for work, and they would use the United States for a job for 8 months. And after everything was built back in Italy like they wanted, that would be it. They would just stop going to New York, and they would return to Italy. So, very interesting. I'd really like to see if there's something about that, yeah.
Mark, well, thank you very, very much. Your study, obviously, is involved not only in Maltese diaspora studies and obviously in ethnic studies, but what's come out from today's discussion, is that Catholic studies of evolving international Catholicism, are very much the center of a growing center of attention. You are our first speaker in the seminar series on ethnic diaspora issues, but for some time I've been trying to get a friend of anthropologists in Malta from the United States, Professor Robert Orsi at Northwestern University. He is professor of religious studies there, and his field of speciality is Catholic religion. And he's written, among many other books, he's written a beautiful ethnography of Catholic Italians in Boston through three generations. So thank you for opening up this whole new area for our attention, and best of luck in your future studies, and we look forward to seeing you back in Malta.
Thank you.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Maltese Catholicism in Detroit. This talk was delivered by Professor Mark Sanko.